dime stores and bus stations. People talk of situations, read books, repeat quotations, draw conclusions on the wall.
Okay, I'm here with Bill Brown, who some listeners might know as Bill Not Bored.
Yes, that's correct.
With an exclamation point.
Well, the magazine and the website has an exclamation point, but in my name, there's none. No.
No need for an exclamation point.
No need.
Because you're not bored.
That's right.
So, yeah, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, about Not Bored, and about the kind of work you do today.
Okay, well, thank you for having me on the show, Andy, and hello to the audience, the listening audience. Not Bored was founded in 1983, originally because I needed a vehicle for an article that I had written about David Bowie that was not published by the Ann Arbor News, where I was a rock journalist for a couple of years. And it was done as a one-off to distribute this one text. And I got the name out of something that turned out to be already situationist, which was Tom Wolfe had described certain rock musicians as looking gloriously bored, in particular the Rolling Stones and David Bowie and others. And he said based on this idea that they look bored, and this was an objection, I thought, well, as a punk, I thought, I agree. We want musicians, and we want to be not bored. And that became the name of the journal. It was only after that I was introduced to the situationists that I discovered that there was a situationist slogan saying, boredom is counter-revolutionary, which had been done decades before I had found out about it. And I found there was a natural affinity I had for the situationist idea because of this idea of refusing boredom. And also it seemed to jive with a good deal of the rhetoric of punk at that time, which was saying no, that the larger the no, the more insistent the no, the better, and that yes would have to be a very, very small aspect of it, but the no, the insistence on no future, no heroes, not bored, all was of a piece.
Mm-hmm. And Hegel says that history moves on its bad side, and of course we understand proletarian revolution as the negation of the negation.
That's right.
So over the course of this episode, I think we're going to try to weave together a few different things. We're going to talk about your background in punk and in anarchism. We're going to talk about the situationists, especially Vanagam, who you've done a lot of work translating, including the recent Resistance to Christianity.
That's right.
That just came out from, was it Aris Press?
Aris Books.
Aris Books. And yeah, we'll try to connect all that stuff. Should be fun. And yeah, I had the idea of talking to you because I saw you talk about Resistance to Christianity at this event at NYU, hosted by, what was the name of the group that hosted you?
That was the
Center for Unpopular Culture. It's a great name.
Sukdev Sandhu. Sandhu Sukdev is the professor who runs it. Yes, and it's a lecture series that he invited me to take part in.
And I expected you, because the topic of the book is written by Vanagam, you recently translated it, is the history of heretic Christian sects, a sort of dictionary-like catalog of these sects. And I thought that would be mostly what you're talking about, but I was really surprised when you gave your introduction. You were talking a lot about how you came to your politics and situationism through punk in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's a very similar story to mine, although I came into my politics through punk in the 2000s, but also to situationism, because at punk shows during that time, you would often see someone tabling with zines. A lot of these zines were from Crime Think, and Crime Think was directly influenced by the situationists.
That's correct.
Specifically by Vanagam.
Yes, correct. I mean, the revolution of everyday life.
Yeah, you'll see Debord quotes in there, but you'll see a lot more references to Vanagam. And so I thought it'd be a great topic for an episode. So yeah, let's get back to how you found situationism through punk. Was it through Gril Marcus's Lipstick Traces?
No, he had not yet written Lipstick Traces.
Okay.
He wrote a book review of Ken Nabb's Situationist International anthology. And the anthology was a self-published work, a remarkable work, translated, edited, and published by Ken Nabb, who had been a post-situationist active in California in the 1970s and 80s. And Marcus's book review, since he himself wrote about rock music, focused on the obvious influence that the Situationists had on the Sex Pistols. which was not just in their lyrics, but in the album design, their clothing, their approach to the mass media, their attitudes about consumerisms and commodities. And it really caught me. At that time, the anthology was the only thing that you could really find in English. And as a result of Greil's book review in 1984, two more works were published in English, or republished. There had been prior versions of Debord's book, Society of the Spectacle, and Van Eyckham's Revolution of Everyday Life. So between 83 and 84, there was a really big uptick in interest in the Situationists, and specifically in the punk milieu, so that a number of punk bands, and it's, I don't think anybody has really focused on how pervasive the effect was, especially in Britain, that it isn't just the Sex Pistols, especially the Gang of Four, are thoroughly imbued with Situationist theory, in part because the person who they worked with at Leeds University when they were art students was Timothy Clark, an ex-member of the International of the British Section. Gang of Four, Sex Pistols, X-Ray Specs, also The Clash to an extent.
Timothy Clark, different than T.J. Clark,
same
right?
thing, same person.
Same guy.
T.J. stands for Timothy John, I believe.
Okay, got it. So it
was taken for granted in Britain, and in the United States, there's also a number of different groups, the Avengers, the Minutemen. Some of the SST groups also were aware of the Situationists, but nothing had been really done in a comprehensive way. People really focused on their slogans, graffiti that was written during May 1968, and it wasn't until much later that Greil Marcus wrote Lipstick Traces, Secret History of the 20th Century, that really focused in depth not only on the not only just on punk, prior to that, the Situationists, prior to them, the Letterist International, and prior to them, certain medieval heretical Christian movements. So that really opened the field on a number of different levels. And over the course of the 1980s, the Situationists became very strongly interested in the academic milieu. So that the Institute for Contemporary Arts had a big retrospective in 1989. They suddenly surged into consciousness, at least in the musical and academic worlds.
So if people aren't familiar with Lipstick Traces or Greil Marcus's work in general, highly recommended. I think Lipstick Traces, fair to say, is the best book about punk, right?
Yes, I think so. Mostly because it isn't just about punk. I mean, it focuses in very, very minutely on anarchy in the UK, which bears up under the scrutiny. It's a song that in its way is also thoroughly Situationist, and even though I think the Situationists would have rejected it, would not have understood it, because their European culture was not really had no sympathy for Anglo-American popular culture. And there's a real split in the international between people like Donald Nicholson Smith, Clark, the American Situationists, and then the Europeans and the French, that they had a very different cultural sensibility.
And it seems like to me the way those politics get into the Sex Pistols was from Malcolm McLaren.
And Jamie Reed.
Okay.
That McLaren gets most of the credit, and he, deservedly so, but Jamie Reed, who did their album design, had done a zine called Suburban Press, starting in 1971. And he really worked on the theory of the situation. It's not just a couple of slogans or some images, really worked on expanding their ideas and how it was relevant to the class structure in England, to tenement housing. And he's the one that showed Johnny Rotten, apparently showed him Leaving the 20th Century, which was the first anthology of Situationist translations into English by Christopher Gray, another member of the English group. So he deserves some credit as well for it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that McLaren was a sincere Situationist, or did he see some... Because this is the guy that got the Sex Pistols together, gave them their outfits... influence their lyrics and music in certain ways, sort of like when punks say that the Sex Pistols were a boy band, mm-hmm. It's not exactly untrue,
right?
But they were certainly a very avant-garde boy band, and I think punks today don't treat them that way. They kind of think of them as an afterthought, as like goofy, not like a mm-hmm. serious band. But anyone who's read Lipstick Traces knows how much there is there. But how much of McLaren's project was political, and how much of it was aesthetic?
Okay, well, he gets a lot of shit, mostly because of the lawsuits that were, that were brought by John Rotten and John Lydon and the other Sex Pistols, and he gets a lot of bad press from the Sex Pistols. And I think it's very easy to simply assume that McLaren was just a huckster, that he was only interested in politics or in punk very briefly. And I think that's only true if you take the Sex Pistols and their own perspective and lawsuits. But if you actually look at McLaren's own history and listen to him speak about his own life, you see that this was a lifelong rebel, that he grew up in a very, very difficult background and was raised by his grandmother, who told him to always be a rebel, always to fight. And you look at the various things that he did, especially with his shop, he wasn't simply catering to various political trends. He was actually trying to change cultural trends and was very, very influential over the course of several incarnations of the bookstore. And then he continued to be active in the music business afterward and did a number of interesting musical projects. So I would say that his interest in the politics of it was quite legitimate. He performed extremely well under pressure. His ideas for how to bring Sex Pistols publicity via scandal was very, very effective. So if you want to say that his politics was the politics of scandal, he was very, very effective and committed to it, yes.
Mm-hmm. And if I could choose one quote from Raoul Vanagam's The Revolution of Everyday Life that really sums up the connection between punk situationists and the radical avant-garde that precede situationism, is from, I think, the punkish chapter, Unbuttressed Refusal.
Okay.
Where he says, juvenile delinquents are the legitimate heirs to Dada.
Right.
So he writes this what? In
It's written between 63 and 65 and okay, published so in 67.
This is at a time when, around when rock and roll is moving from the sort of phenomenon of Elvis Presley and like moving from R&B to the form we know it today of these rock groups or rock bands who sort of are play acting as gangs in a way.
Bang, bang, bang. Trying to stop my fun, but there's a riot going on. There's a riot going on.
And the Beatles were kind of like warm and fuzzy and cuddly and cute, but they're a boy band, but like a lot of the other bands took on this juvenile delinquent kind of affect. It comes from Rock Around the Clock, or, you know, inspired riots when people first saw it. And so you see the same sort of thing happening with this return to rock and roll in the late 70s with bands like the Ramones, who were like nice kids from Queens who put on leather jackets, call themselves the Ramones, and act like tough guys. And so this predates the Sex Pistols, but there's this thing happening of like delinquency and youth culture returning to rock and roll at a moment when it was moving towards like prog and stadium rock and that sort of thing. So I think McLaren seeing this connects the two, connects, you know, the historical avant-garde of Dada, letterism into situationism with punk.
Right. Well, Vanagam is famous for saying that he was interested in taking the nihilism of the juvenile delinquents and raising it to the level of critical theory. So he didn't see it simply as teaching the punks what their theory is. It was to teach theorists about the abrasiveness and the truthfulness and rawness of punk.
And so, yeah, what else would you say about Vanagam specifically, and maybe the situationists more in general, their politics that really fits into punk as it developed?
Well, it's a very complicated subject because the situationists themselves were not very much interested in music, and the music that they were interested in was classical music, or at least in Debord in his films, is looking to classical music and makes fun of Cliff Richard and other pop stars in Society of the Spectacle. So that you don't really see, they're not really connected to it in the same way. But what the relationship of the situations within themselves is very, very complicated. They had a sort of monolithic appeal, or gave themselves the approach that these were people who are collectively agreed on a number of different premises and actions, but they're actually very, very different. And Vanagam ends up being the odd person out. He's very influential in the first few years that he's joined between 61 and 65. This was the era in which the International reinvented itself, in particular in response to wildcat strikes in Belgium, delinquent riots in England and the United States, various outbreaks in France as well. But Vanagam is inside the SI, but also outside of it, because once he publishes The Revolution of Everyday Life, apparently he then just takes a back seat and is not very active in May 1968. He was on vacation during the main, when the event started. He came in, even though there was a general strike emerging, signed one of the situationist circulars, and then departed again, without really being cognizant of the fact that that the movement of May 1968 was more than going to be just a week or two, and potentially could go on for several months and topple the French government. And Debord never forgave Vanagam for this.
This is a good lesson for all the listeners out there. If it's popping off, you got to go. Even if you're on vacation, you know, no matter what you're doing, when it goes down, which it has, in 2020 and will again, you got to get there.
Yeah, that's right. And that you, and at that point, you really have to show that all that time you were serious. Mm-hmm. And that what emerges from Van Eyckham there afterwards is a kind of, and I hate to say this because I admire some of his writing so much, but as far as his own practical activity is, he becomes a kind of a tourist. So that when he hears that there's revolutionary events taking place in Portugal in 74 and 75, he apparently goes down there with a couple of copies of his latest book, meets a couple of people, and then leaves. Where de Boer, at the same time, had been working with a couple of Portuguese situationists and anarchists, people who translated Society of the Spectacle into Portugal. De Boer had been already focused on it and remained focused on Portugal for several years thereafter. And this also typifies de Boer's attitude towards events in Italy, in Spain, and in other countries, where Van Eyckham, visits Greece, visits the anarchist neighborhood in Greece, but then leaves again. And so one doesn't really look to him as a model for political engagement. One looks to him for something a lot more ephemeral and hard to grasp, which would be an attitude towards living, an attitude towards historical research. But if one's really interested in exactly what political action or what's the proper political attitude to take at certain moments and in general, one does not look to him, but would look to de Boer, Sanguinetti, René Rizel, other members of the group, and not Van Eyckham.
So to get a little bit more into Revolution of Everyday Life, that's the only book by Van Eyckham I've really read. I know he's written quite a bit more. But one thing he wrote, actually in the 2010 introduction, which I think also sort of jibes with punk, especially anarcho-punk, pretty well, he says, quote, "A new society is being built in secret, that genuinely human relationships are coming into being. Relationships able to create zones of freedom where existence can free itself from the diktats of the commodity, banishing competition in the name of emulation and work in the name of creativity." So this reminded me a lot of the ethos of anarcho-punk, of
yes,
we're not simply pop bands trying to, scandalize the rock and roll market and make some money while we do it. We're trying to create an entirely new world, an entirely new people, in a way, around the punk culture, which begins with the Ramones, the Sex Pistols, like a bohemian scene in downtown New York, but then pretty rapidly progresses into a new identity and a new way of living around this semi-mythical transgressive punk subjectivity.
Right. Well, you're describing the early 80s quite well, mm-hmm, where there actually is an infrastructure that's being made of tour bands, places that they can crash, homemade studios, zines, cassette exchanges, maybe some pirate radio stations, and that is, there's no aspiration to a national audience or breaking through and sort of attacking the music industry as a whole or face on. This attempt to make a small little culture within itself that will survive and build new relations, especially ones where it's not a commodified one so much as one of exchange. However, there does become an identity that becomes locked in, which is in the hardcore identity, which is not only is it a musical style, a way of living, but it's also a rejection of mainstream society as a whole. And there's, in some ways, a very positive aspect to that, in that it's small and integrated and organic, but it's also an abandonment of some larger problems. Mm-hmm. And these scenes can become very, very insulated and then ultimately end up regressing, because there isn't a constant influx of outside ideas. And so it can actually rigidify into a very strict role and sound and personality.
Yeah, and we see this tension in Van Eyckham's work as well, because where de Boer really, in Society of the Spectacle, for example, is like looking at the totality, understanding life in modern capitalism through this concept of the spectacle and offering a program of a sort of workers' council revolution as the way out of it. Van Eyckham is, I think he agrees with all that. I think they did have a unified theory during the 60s, but he was very focused on the subjective of revolution beginning in one's own subjectivity, not isolated from collectivity or from society as a whole, but in a dialectical relationship with it. And at one point in Revolution of Everyday Life, he writes, "The new revolutionary society emerges as a chain reaction from one subjectivity to the next," which I think it is sort of the conceit of the, if punks had been revolutionary at some point, they might have thought, well, like, we're creating our own revolutionary counterculture that'll be autonomous, and other people will do the same as well, and we'll link up or something.
Right.
Do you think that's a fair vision of, like, the more revolutionary?
I think it's a fair vision of a federation of autonomous groups. But I think the value, again, the disadvantage and the value of Society of the Spectacle is the ambition to talk about the totality. And that this is one of the great successes of the book is to not only, I don't know if it's successful at viewing the totality of capitalist society, but it valorizes the attempt to do so. And this stands out against a good deal of structuralist theory and post-structuralist theory and postmodernism, which is to say that it's impossible to do that. And there's a general agreement that any narrative that attempts to talk about the totality of society is ultimately going to end up being authoritarian. And there's a rejection of it. But it seems to me that the healthiest impulse is to say, well, I'm going to act locally, but think, but think globally, which is a slogan that was picked up by the hippie and countercultural movement and is apparently sourced in Van Eyck.
Oh.
So that there's a key aspect of how one's work done in a local context is actually has an aspiration to be adopted globally, and whether it's going to be simply as a result of a federation of autonomous groups or just without any confrontation with the central authority, or there is going to be the necessity of some sort of confrontation at some point, because otherwise you end up just not just stagnating but being satisfied with the small gains that you've managed to achieve, and that ultimately may not be able to regenerate interest in it from generation to generation. So it's precisely the charm that Du Bois's work has in retrospect, is that this is a small book that has the impossible aspiration to speak of the entire history of Western civilization and capitalism. And in many ways, that's part of the thrill of the book.
Right.
Is that it inspires people to be able to say, I'm going to look up from the specific things that I'm focused on and see what does the rest of the world look like? And that what you see when you look at the rest of the world is our problems are not so unique. Our problems are united with a variety of different situations around the world, and there are other people fighting against those conditions that we may not have known about.
Yeah, the concision of it is so remarkable. I'm just constantly reading it and rereading it and finding new things in it. I mean, it's also the case of Vanaygham, but he's a very different, he is not a concise writer, you know? Like, the book that you've just translated is very long. Revolution of Everyday Life is not particularly long, but it's very dense. There's just so much in there. And there are some lines, I mean, this is true of Society of the Spectacle as well, but there are some lines that you just have to read over and over again to try to figure out what he's saying. These very difficult, circuitous sentences, I guess.
Well, it's in Vanaygham's case, that's especially hard because he has a very flourishing rhetorical approach, and that the style of it sometimes can be more easily understood in French than it is in English. Du Bois is much more epigrammic. He would probably be a better lyricist than Du Bois, than Van Eyck is. And that's sort of the punk quality that the Society Spectacle has, which is it's short and fast.
So you think Du Bois is in a way more punk than Van Eyck?
I think, well, at least the way their books are written, and that punk is in some ways ends up sounding like folk music when it ends up being too subjective.
Mm.
And that there's the best punk is seems to be not so focused on individual people or individual problems that people are having, but comment on things on the larger sense. So that's why Anarchy in the UK is such an incredible song, in that it's clearly talking about the entirety of British society, not just talking about how he feels in his squat, how he feels in a certain neighborhood of London. The aspiration is to take in the entire country.
Mm-hmm. You know, I love that line of well, it's in Holidays in the Sun, of like, going to the Berlin Wall and just confronting it and envisioning going over it, not because you're a Bolshevik or something, but just because you see it as another barrier to your freedom.
Right.
This sort of fascination, simultaneous fascination and disinterest with the way the world works, with this underlying drive to just destroy and traverse everything.
Well, the narrator of that song seems to be caught up in something much bigger than himself. So that he's going to the Berlin Wall, apparently not because he wants to, but now he's got a reason. And the reason is the economy. Mm. And that he's being picked up and pushed into this historical confrontation with the wall. And as I mentioned in my talk that you saw at NYU, the last minute or so of the Holiday of the Sun is something that could not be reproduced very easily, which is you sense that the singer, the narrator, becomes very confused and is thrust into this position, and he says, "I'm going to go over the Berlin Wall. I'm going to go under the Berlin Wall. I don't understand this bit at all." And it doesn't sound like a conceit or a gimmick. You actually get the sense of chaos that something is happening, and that there's some sort of climax is going to be reached, or that we're going to be breaking through, and that's a remarkable accomplishment for, just as you said before, a pop song.
Mm-hmm. And I think why a lot of punks my age, at least, don't really appreciate the Sex Pistols this way is because they don't take the, you know, explicit political stances. I'm not sure if Gang of Four really did either. Of course, you see The Clash and other mm-hmm. bands in that scene more taking this popular front, like Rock Against Racism type, joining in with the SWP or what have you. Whereas with the Sex Pistols, what you get is this nihilism, this confusion, this dissatisfaction. You know, how can you join the SWP if you sincerely believe that there's no future, right? And I think in a way, anarcho-punk, like as we understand it through like the peace punk bands in the United States or through the Crass Records bands in England, also rejected this because mm-hmm. while, you know, Crass was, you know, uniquely kind of, like a neo-hippie, you know, they were a little bit more interesting politically than a lot of anarcho-punk. What you see, especially today, is anarcho-punk bands have to take these firm stances, have to make their lyrics kind of like clear about what side they're on a certain issue. And even if I totally agree with the side they're taking, I do think that tends to make the music a little bit more boring.
Right. Well, it's as if they wrote the lyrics first and then wrote the music mm-hmm. instead of either making it an organic creation of both at the same time, or simply wrote a very good song and later discovered what the lyrics would be, which I think is probably a better aesthetic approach, which is that the lyrics in some ways don't really matter that much. That some of the Sex Pistols lyrics embodies, for example, where fuck this and fuck this is not necessarily a lyric that they spent a very long time on putting down, and that it's not necessarily a function of every single song, every single line in every single song having a demonstrable meaning, but conveying an emotion, and that emotion may be where the heart of the politics is rather than a particular position again about whether it's abortion, women's rights, anti-war movement, anti-nuclear movement. Then you're just checking off boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very juvenile to say, fuck this, fuck that, I want to destroy. It's very vulgar. But then again, you know, if we're inspired by proletarian riots and mm-hmm. wildcat strikes who say, well, fuck the strategy of the union or whatever, we're going to do this regardless of what's proper or even regardless of the consequences. That is, I think, when we talk about like a punk attitude, that's what the punk attitude is. It's not being yes. like a good person or even an ethical person. It's about this transgression against the way things are that may fall anywhere on the political spectrum.
Right. A transgression, but also a willingness to live with the consequences, and a transgression that would push those consequences as far as possible, and to say, I do not know what's going to happen after this point, where it seems in most, either whether it's musical performances or in political things, if somebody in a unionizer or a Communist Party or the Democratic Party or a rights group calls for a demonstration or some sort of protest, you pretty much have an idea of what's going to happen. It doesn't have an opening at the other end of it where you do not know what's going to happen, mm-hmm. whether it's going to lead to a sit-in, an occupations movement, whether it's going to lead to a riot. You know if you're going to go at the beginning, you know how it's going to go at the end. So I think the punk attitude is to be able to say, I'm opening this box up and I do not know what's going to happen thereafter.
And this is why I think the Revolution of Everyday Life is a more proper text informing that kind of punk politics, because subjectivity, like we said, is prioritized. And so, you know, if you're an activist, for example, if you're organizing towards a specific goal, you don't really have to, you kind of have to like put your subjectivity aside mm-hmm. because you're fighting on behalf of refugees or behalf of the earth or of stopping a war or something. And you lose yourself not necessarily like you could be part of the group that you are advocating for, but often as an activist, you're not.
Right.
And so the idea of revolutionizing everyday life instead of, well, I'm going to join this party or this group and fight for this cause is really two different approaches to politics.
Yes. Dismissed by the situation as militancy or militantism, as in you're ignoring your everyday life when you get back from the demonstration, as in you're living the same routine that you had been before you left, and that nothing has really changed in it. The revolution of everyday life is really mostly focused around housing, it seems to me, that the most interesting aspects of where punk took on was in squatted buildings and its connection to a reclaimed urban space. And I think that's an aspect that should be explored more. That the revolution of everyday life is not just simply waking up in the morning and not going to work, but it's that you have the freedom not to be able to go to work because you've squatted a building or lived in some sort of reclaimed space, and therefore don't have to turn over 50% of your income to a landlord. Therefore, you don't have to work as much as that is concerned, that you can take off 50% of your time, leaving you a great deal of free time to be able to develop yourself as a person. So I think that that connection of what everyday life is specifically how we live in buildings and what our homes are like and what our housing situation is like, whether we're living in a rented area and paying a lot of money or owning a building or living in a way that's a lot more free from specific confinement in a certain space.
Yeah, another situation, a slogan is no more life without dead time. And Vanagam, I don't know if that's Vanagam's line, but...
It's one of the graffiti in May 1968 that derives from his book.
And that's part of this sort of tension that he has throughout the book between life and death, which of course comes from Marx, dead labor versus living labor. Right. But then also the concept that life is meant to be lived as long as we are breathing, as long as we're living, we have a chance to resist the boredom and the death and the wage labor and rents of capitalist society and figure out how to live in a different way. And a lot of your writing in Not Bored comes from the squatters movement in New York. Was there a direct influence there? What were the anarcho-punks or the people that you were squatting with or that you saw squatting? What were they thinking along
the squats,
lines?
The squats and the community gardens precede my return to New York City. The other people were very much involved in the squats, especially in the Lower East Side. The squat that I was involved in was in Williamsburg. We took over an abandoned factory and lived in the basement for almost a year. And that was very, very productive experience for me because I did not have to work that entire year and could get by on very little money and managed to be very, very creative. And that's right, I lost part of what your question was in retrieving that.
Well, just the sort of political attitude that you saw amongst the anarcho-punk squatters. Because anarcho-punks weren't the only squatters. I think a lot of people think that today. But in Williamsburg specifically, the reason South Williamsburg is still Latino is because a lot of those buildings are co-ops that they won through sweat equity, essentially squatting. And so you when like real estate markets sort of turn around, when a lot of those squats get normalized in the 80s into the 90s, the squats that are still resist and are still very public are more the anarcho-punk squats.
Right. The thing that I was most involved in the 80s in the Lower East Side in defending reclaimed territory was the community gardens. Because the community gardens were an equivalent of squatting abandoned land as opposed to squatting an abandoned building. And the gardens became social centers in themselves. They became both areas where families could go, the squatters and community gardeners could recreate an environment for themselves. And that fits more the situationist slogan of a constructed situation, that the community gardens included gardens, murals, flower beds, some casitas where people were living. And I was very involved in the defense of them because the Giuliani administration bore down very, very hard on them, not only all over the city, but especially in the Lower East Side. And a good deal of the anarcho-punks that I knew, both in the squats and at Blackout Books, were involved in the defense of those squats, whether it was ringing the building with supporters when the cops came to evict everybody or knock the building down, or to be involved in treetop sit-ins in the gardens, having demonstrations at the local councilmen's offices. Various groups got very militant and released thousands of crickets into councilmen's meetings to be able to disrupt it and to say that the gardens would not be sold off. So there was a strong interplay back and forth between those things, which was not only the politics, but the politics needed a space to be executed in and to be inspired by, which is, I think, a common theme of what we're saying, which is politics is not something that exists outside of a given space, where the space provides an area where the politics can be developed and extend themselves.
And did you see factions of the anarcho-punks that did have a broader revolutionary concept of what they were doing? Because reading about the squatting movement of the early 90s, it did seem very cultural in the sense that, of course, they were trying to defend their squats and the freedom that they had there and the way of life that they had there. But then beyond that, there was a defense of homeless people, mm-hmm. like living in Tompkins Square Park and elsewhere, and a rejection of gentrification, especially the yuppies. There's a lot of like anti-yuppie graffiti and, mm-hmm. and action and stuff. But, you know, to me, that doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It's like you're treating the symptoms of the market, but you know, you're just trying to maintain your freedom as the market tries to crush you.
Well, there were some small, in general, I agree. There were some small inroads made, like Food Not Bombs is seeing a need and meeting it and in a positive way rather than simply finding the latest thing to protest against and protesting against it. So there were certain efforts done to be able to create an infrastructure of a newer way of dealing with things, which is taking food that comes would have been thrown out from a restaurant in a dumpster and then be able to prepare it and give it to people for free in Tompkins Square Park or some other place. But by and large, yes, there was not an overall sense of the significance of what a reclaimed building was. And I think that might have been because it seemed to be too academic or too book-related, mm-hmm. and in the meantime, people felt an immediatism. And that lent itself to, say, an absence of real strategic thinking, or at least critical thinking about how does this movement fit in with other ones, rather than just saying, well, we're doing the best that we can under very difficult situation.
You were writing Not Bored, I assume, as sort of an intervention to get people to think this way. How was it received when you would write situationist-inspired commentary on the sort of politics and actions that were happening?
Well, what I tried to do was to divide the magazine, the journal, into two halves, which was a theoretical half, which is, okay, I'm reading these books, I'm writing these book reviews, I'm learning these theories, I'm seeing connections to others. And then in a separate section of the journal called What's Happening. So it would be whatever's happening in the town that I was living in, which was a concrete example of something that you could do with these theories to be able to say, okay, I understand that you're working out some theories and understanding how it fits to America in the 1980s or 1990s rather than France in the 50s or 60s, but how does this actually play out in terms of your own actions? And that the journal basically participated in two major graffiti scandals, which were attempts to intercede in specific places with highly political content, but not so much in the traditional way of finding a demonstration or against a specific issue, but saying this particular space is going to be visited by a number of people, and it's a lot of focus on it. If we hit this area repeatedly, it's going to create some sort of impact. And the first time this happened was in Buffalo. There was a hallway in one of the universities that was going to be decorated by a frat, and the frat had a spectacular sort of opening for artists to be able to submit designs. And in the meantime, it left this hallway open to be attacked by graffiti writers. And my friends and I hit it again and again and again and again, over and over again, with graffiti and flyers explaining the graffiti. And the frat got wind of it, and they end up turning it into a big scandal. It became something in the student newspapers and the daily newspapers of Buffalo. And that was precisely a situationist form of political activity, which is to break through of the boredom where people are not shocked by the news, that there's nothing that they find scandalous, that nothing is scandalous anymore, nothing is really threatening or unusual, and to be able to show that it was still possible to create some sort of scandal. And to focus on what it was, the scandal was content was. Not only was it that hallway, but it was the participation of the frats. The second thing was the graffiti scandal in Williamsburg in the 1990s, which was also very successful because if you hit someplace again and again and again and you're relentless and you don't really care what the response is, knowing you've got a good target and that if it feels right to you, it'll work out. So that I was very, very gratified by the fact that that also turned into a pretty big scandal about, well, who's a yuppie? Who are you to say who's not a yuppie is? Well, who's moving in? Why is Williamsburg so important? And it opened the conversation in a way that simply protesting at a landlord's place or protesting at the community board would not have accomplished, and gave the sense that this is something that was exciting because it was scandalous, and you wondered, well, I'm not sure how I feel about this, but this conversation has been opened.
So I moved to Williamsburg in 2006, which is like the height of the hipster era. And part of the reason I moved there was not only because I liked the Strokes and the Yeah and stuff like that and other punk bands that usually played in Williamsburg, but because at that point, the hipster scene was very political. It was deeply inspired by the riots against the WTO and subsequent movements. I mean, you had bands like The Hives, the International Noise Conspiracy, even The Strokes had a song attacking New York City cops. There was a moment when there was this connection between like the anti-war movement, even Palestine solidarity, like there was a rhetoric back then that's sort of similar to today where the keffiyeh was like a hipster signifier, even though people were wearing it in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. And I'm wondering how you feel about watching that resistance to gentrification in the 90s turn into this political hipster movement, and then immediately after that completely depoliticized hipster movement, which virtually everyone connected with gentrification to the point when hipster became like a synonym for yuppie.
Right. Well, what you pointed to, I want to underline, which was that there was a real change in the American social political context at the end of the 80s and the beginning, at the end of the 1990s and the beginning of 2000, not just because of Occupy, but the anti-WTO protests were a major development in American anti-authoritarian political culture. And I don't think it gets the attention that it did, that it should be getting, because of how successful it was and how scandalous it was, that people were scandalized by the fact that the Black Bloc was so effective in both attacking certain aspects of private property, these very big corporate entities, but in defending itself as well. Even though there was serious violence then brought again against the protests and the residents of Seattle, it turned out, but that its importance in changing the way people looked at things was very important. So what I did was prior to that in Williamsburg, and was there were no real politically involved hipsters in Williamsburg at that time. It was mostly because the rents were beginning to actually double and triple, and that generation of people had not yet moved in and moved in. So the people that then moved in after that, after the World Economic Forum meeting of 2002, there was a big, big change. And yes, I would agree that politics became cool again. And that may very well have been a very good event because it was cool again to become political, but also it was had a bit of a sense of we're just following the latest trend, and the latest trend is to be political and to be able to take these stances, rather than saying, no, I've been political all through this and I've weathered ups and downs. Now it becomes fashionable, bespeaks of what the end is going to be like, which is no longer fashionable. Or you've taken your fashionable politics, reached a certain level of artistic success, and the activism is the thing that falls away. And what you're left with is contemporary modern art, which is very, very empty of content. Its politics seems to be identity politics and just, you know, cueing or just signifying allegiance in a certain oppressed group or allegiance with an oppressed group, and doesn't have the organic feeling of challenging all of capitalism the way you certainly saw the challenge raised in 1999 in Seattle.
One thing I've been thinking about a lot recently, I've been rereading Fight Club. Have you read Fight Club or
Yes.
seen the movie? And I reread it and rewatched it because it came out in November 99, so like a month before WTO hits. So you have this smash hit movie that's essentially about anarchism. I mean, it's not so they're not so simply an anarchist group. There's also this men's rights aspect to it, and it's very easy to see it. Project Mayhem is more of a fascist project than a left anarchist project. But it struck me that if you were, if you asked a normal person about what an anarchist was in the 90s, what would they think? Like, would they think like the singer of Rage Against the Machine, like a hippie with dreadlocks and militant politics? Because after WTO, what people think is the Black Bloc. They right. think of what you think of when you say an anarchist today, like basically a street ninja who's like mm-hmm. smashing a Starbucks window or fighting a fascist or a cop or something.
Right. Yes, I agree. That's the public perception.
So what was anarchism like in the 90s? Like, and what was the public perception of it?
I'm not sure about what the public perception of it, but at least anarchism in the 90s was, at least in some aspects, a lot more interested in not just a cultural milieu, but political, but the political situation. The Unabomber for President campaign, which was an anarchist project that I was involved in 1996, was something attempting to, again, sort of be opposed to the entire political order, not just to say, I want to sponsor an alternative candidate, a green candidate, something like that, but to put into nomination somebody who's completely unacceptable, associated with violence, associated with the critique of capitalism and industrial society. So I would say that would be representative, I would think, of the 1990s, which was a little more savvy in terms of the way that media was dealt with, a little savvy in the sense of keeping it at a distance, rather than saying, well, the media is just another tool that we use to put our message out. I think it's still, in the 90s, there was still a feeling of saying, we're going to be doing our thing, we're going to be attempting to reach other people, but we're suspicious of how the media is going to treat us, and that there'll be some distance between us and the people who write about us, rather than afterwards it seemed to be, we're going to become the media itself. And I think that changes the attitude towards it, which is a change in attitude toward technology, towards that the bigger the viewership, the better the message, rather than saying it's the quality of the message, and it's more likely that the smaller the audience is going to be really a qualitative response. These are generalizations, but I can only speak from my personal experience and what it overlaps with the other things that I've observed other people have been doing.
I mean, I think obviously a lot of the new left writers, including the Situationist, were struggling with this problem of, all right, so we're going to detourn culture. We're going to culture jam in various ways, which the Ted K for President thing seems like a kind of culture jamming.
Yes.
And in Fight Club, you see like a mixture of pranks. Tyler Durden sends the Project Mayhem people out to do Situationist style pranks. But then it escalates to like bombing a Starbucks and then eventually to destroying several high-rise financial towers in Manhattan, right. Which I think also kind of presages 9/11 and the reaction, right. the kind of security state that comes after that. But it strikes me that the cultural fetishization of chaos that you see people won over to after Fight Club or after WTO sort of sets the stage for this new round of politics becoming cool, like you said, and the gentrification that comes from that, where you get a person like me saying, well, I am bored in the suburbs, or I'm bored going to some state school upstate. I want to be where the action is in Williamsburg, where there are protests all the time, where there are squats and punk shows and stuff. And in retrospect, it kind of feels like to me I had just bought into an alternative cultural trend that put me where I was supposed to be as like a different sort of urban professional working in the counterculture instead of, you know, wherever else I could have ended up from my middle class background.
Right. Well, I think the attitude, and this goes back to something we were saying before we started recording, was, okay, that's the way you ended up. Or that's the way your situation became. But is that something that you're going to be able to work your way through and remain political and not just abandon it all? So you were saying that there's many people for whom, as they get older, their political ideologies or their political investments fade away. So that you can't be too difficult on yourself to saying, well, I bought into gentrification by doing this. I lived in this particular place. That's all forgivable, provided that you're able to continue to develop beyond that instead of saying, okay, I got caught up in gentrification, I got caught up in spectacularization, I give up. Mm-hmm. That there's no way to resist those things than saying I got caught up in it and saying, okay, that's it. There's no possible radical or revolutionary activity that isn't going to end up somehow co-opted. And I think the best attitude is to say, yes, this is something that has been faced for 150 years of bohemian culture, 150 years of mm-hmm. revolutionary culture. And the question is not saying giving up when you find that you've been recuperated or that you feel guilty about it, by saying, okay, I need to rethink, rather than saying I need to completely withdraw.
Going back to the Situationist, there's sort of the way I read their movement from Letcherism to their late 60s work is this recognition that, like, the cultural vanguards were once sort of the vanguard of revolutionary politics. You know, you had, like, a large member of the establishment of the Fourth International, for example, were also surrealists and Dadaists of some regard. And I think in the 60s, they started to feel like, well, the cultural vanguard is no longer the political vanguard. And this is not only a crisis for politics, but a crisis for art, because we can't make revolutionary art anymore. We need to make highly politicized situations led by a political vanguard to make revolutionary art, poetry, etc., possible, which can lead you to a sort of state of hopelessness, I guess, or like towards like a maybe a sectarian position of like, well, I'm going to read as much Debord and like punish everybody else who hasn't read it correctly. And that's where I think Vanigam is so refreshing, because you pick that book up and it's almost like a self-help book in a way. It's almost like a guide to how you can wake up every morning and realize that your subjectivity is a grounds for revolutionary politics.
Potentially, yes.
As long as you are conceiving of your activity that way, as long as you're trying to de-alienate your activity from broader political struggles.
Right, and with the added idea that, and this goes back to the Dadaists and Surrealists, who also saw themselves as either part of or working alongside of a very powerful working class movement, a movement for a labor movement, a working class movement for the abolition of wage labor and capitalism. And what's happened over the course of that, all that century that separates from Dada and Surrealism, is that workers' movement has collapsed. Or that in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, by the time the Situationists were involved, that workers' movement had completely collapsed. And the labor movement in the United States, the radical labor movement in the United States, has also collapsed as well. So what's missing, the missing aspect of what happened for the Situationists in, say, 1959, and for us now, which is, it's okay to be a political radical or to engage in radical action. The question is it linking up with other people who are fighting against the economy rather than just against aesthetics? Mm-hmm. And that what we talked about when I was at NYU is that the experience of the working class here in America is very different than it had been in Europe, even in England, where I think it was common practice for many, many people to be part of labor unions and communist parties and to be active in the labor movement. And the labor movement has fell apart in the United States, was dismantled. So it's difficult to be able to assume these postures, aesthetic postures, in the absence of some, to be able to say, okay, I'm doing this, and eventually I know I'm going to link up with the strikers who were striking at the UAW plants, or the people who are, you know, refusing to grow crops in California. That is an aspect that is missing, and it seems to be essential in keeping aesthetic things from becoming stale, insulated, ineffective, is to be able to say there must be people who are fighting against capitalism in their workplaces, in the places, other places than simply in the art galleries and the art studios. And that's the difficulty of today, at least in America. You do not hear people talking about the working class, bettering the conditions of the working class or its consciousness. You mostly hear about the middle class, the dwindling middle class. And I think that's something particular to American capitalism, where in other countries, in England and in France and other places, I think one speaks of the working class a lot more easily. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem that has to be worked out in America, which is thinking, who really is the proletariat today? Mm. And what kind of political awareness do they engage in? And it's something that has not really been explored very much. There's one or two political leaders, like Bernie Sanders, who talks about the working class, but this is not a concern of the organized left.
Yeah, well, what do you think on that subject? Like, when you think of the working class in the United States today, who do you think of?
The true working class, or the true lumpen proletariat, would be the homeless population, or the population that is most outside of capitalism. But as far as the working class goes, they are the people who are involved in the food industry, the essential workers that got the people revealed as essential workers after the during the pandemic and afterwards. So you got a glimpse of who they were. But then the focus on them and their concerns really evaporated. The one didn't talk about helping the working class during the pandemic. It was helping essential workers. Mm-hmm. But that's who these essential workers are, precisely who the proletariat is. People for with whom that if they are not at work, the economy does not function. Mm-hmm. But that seems to be a good definition of a proletariat. Without their work, society does not function.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think like it is really a shame that there's been this sort of forgetting of 2020 amongst the left. And even at the time, like so much of the political discourse was focused on the tyranny of mask mandates or like quarantine or like the hypocrisy of it. Of course, the George Floyd uprising puts a different spin on it. I think that's incredibly connected to a rejection of the way the pandemic was handled as well. But there was also a lot of strikes and workplace actions of essential workers saying, you're putting us in really unsafe conditions. We're all getting COVID. We're bringing it back home to our families who we live in because we're proletarians, and they're dying. So, for example, I remember there was a wave of strikes, I think, in the Northwest by mostly migrant farm workers who were saying, like, well, we're working under much harder conditions as a result of certain pandemic measures. Other pandemic measures don't go far enough, and we need better pay, and like we have certain demands over like how we're going to work under these conditions. This is something that wasn't talked about a lot. And then after the pandemic, you see this massive amount of people leaving the workforce, either because they're dead or have long COVID, but also because the sober senses that come from having witnessed that year led a lot of people to refuse work and to try to move into the informal economy in various ways.
Yes, that's right. One doesn't, at least on the left, one doesn't hear very much about the nurses' strikes, that the nurses were not just saying, well, we need not only protection, but we need support for our unions as well. So I think that's got ignored as the pandemic went through, and that now, as we were talking about before, when most people who are opposed to the dominant order think about the pandemic, they're still repelled, still hurting about the masks, about the drive for vaccination, and the way that it was treated, rather than saying, well, what was opened up by the pandemic itself? Mm-hmm. How did the pandemic actually take place? Instead of saying, well, it was responded to in a way that you thought was authoritarian, mm-hmm. and that was, you know, obviously modeling itself for future, you know, class and political control, but it was ignored. Actually, what made the pandemic happen? And indeed, you get to the point where some people will say, again, on the left, there was no pandemic. The entire thing was staged.
Right, right. The COVID deniers.
And, well, the COVID deniers are, ironically, they're on both on the left and on the right.
Yep.
And I think that shows the degree of confusion, that the disorientation that has happened in politics, that a lot of the clarity that one saw, especially after 1989 and the WTO riots, after the World Economic Forum and so forth, now things have become very, very confused, where people are not really sure what reality is. Mm-hmm. And that is a disabling and very difficult thing to deal with, because now the allies that we had on our side, as if our party, as it were, are no longer really solidly there. Mm-hmm. And that they've been that this conspiracism, not the conspiracism itself is something to be condemned, but these particular conspiracies end up sounding a lot like Donald Trump and a lot like the far right. And that means that there's even less interest in maintaining the quality and the conditions of the working class, because obviously Trumpism is the last thing they're concerned with is working class conditions.
Yeah, this way that the kind of left anti-authoritarianism feeds in very well to the kind of right anti-authoritarianism. I think I was thinking about this too when I was reading a little bit of Revolution of Everyday Life, because there's this sort of us versus them quality to it. And it also reminded me of New York hardcore too, where like hardcore in general is very political in a way. Like it tended to come from mostly white working class youth, but then the politics are really abstracted to the point where there's us, there's like the people in the band, in the scene, and we love and support each other. And there's the them that's always very vaguely defined. It could mean anything to anyone. It could mean the Jews to one person. It could mean the capitalist to another person. It could mean the parents to another person or your teachers. And the reflexive rejection of the them often just becomes a sort of misanthropy or a blinding of the connection between your us, the conditions of your us, and everyone else. And is this something that you've talked to Vanagam about in recent years? Because I know some of his writing has been more on this COVID denialist end of things.
He wrote a long essay on the coronavirus, and it verges towards conspiracism. However, but he still was very, very strong on saying, okay, it's quite clear that the government is not going to be able to protect us from the pandemic or is going to issue measures that are counterproductive, and does spend a good deal of that essay and others focusing on we need to be able to have self-help care and be able to create our own nurses, our own hospitals. And there's a strong emphasis there on then recreating a society based on that would be free health care that does not rely on government measures and mandates. So it's rather mixed, which is rather he gets a little concerned with, you know, a paranoia about the government insisting on certain things. And that paranoia overtook a number of people on the left.
Sure did.
But Vanagam remained open to the possibility that this was, no matter how desperate the situation is, it's still possible for people to be able to act by and for themselves. And what's stunning about Vanagam and the conversations that I have with him online through email is he's an absolute optimist, and it's hard to believe how he's able to maintain his optimism despite all the cataloging of all the things that are wrong, all the destruction of the environment, all the health problems that pollution is causing people, the bad quality of food, water, the air, is he remains optimistic to his core about the ability of humanity to be able to put itself back on track. And again, that marks him as very unusual, and I've talked to a number of Marxists who have said that he's far too optimistic, that he should be much more pessimistic than he is. And that's the very quality that makes him attractive in these last 10 or 15, at least the last 10 years, is this optimism that cannot be quenched, cannot be nullified.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think one benefit of reading the Situationists today is that they're describing the miserable conditions, both materially and existentially, of their lives, of their cultures, of the labor movement, of real existing socialism, of globalization. And of course, they're describing this in a time that we see as sort of prelapsarian, as like this, you know, such a golden age that you get figures like J.D. Vance and other pseudo-populists talking like, their political platform is promising this kind of return to this era when things were simpler, when you could have a single family income, for example, or on the left, you would have a strong welfare state. But yet what the Situationists talk about really express the anxieties that we have today about atomization, technology. I remember Vanagam goes into this part early in the book about how everyone is granted some autonomy, but their autonomy is just basically the room in their apartments.
Right.
And like, you're allowed to be autonomous there, but everywhere else, there's no autonomy. Right. And it's really refreshing. And if you look at things in that way, if you look at, say, like the Situationists weren't just griping then about their petty concerns that are so much less than what we have today, but a general condition that is as true then as it is today, I think you can read it in a very optimistic way.
That's right. Well, this is it fits into both his book about Christianity and certain aspects of Debord as well, which is that in the late 80s and early 90s, Debord, as the Soviet Union is collapsing, he sees this as a warning to capitalism as well, saying just because you have now conquered communism, or apparently with the dissolution of the Soviet Union means you've won the Cold War, doesn't guarantee any security at all for the West. And this has been called his chiliastic serenity, that he's coldly calm and serene with the fact that indeed capitalism is still doomed, and that is ultimately an optimistic attitude, rather than saying, well, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, capitalism has taken over the entire world except for China, and is going to remain victorious thereafter, and that he's confident that capitalism will itself fail. In Vanagam's book, what comes up is his attitude towards Christianity, is that it comes to be 1789 and the beheading of the French king and the end of the right of kings. He says he can stop right there, saying this: if you follow this vector out, you're looking at the absolute collapse of Christianity on a global scale. And so he's not really willing to be able to talk about the 19th century or the 20th century as Christianity continues to dissolve. He just says, I've seen the end of it, and I'm counting on the end of it. So his afterword to the book doesn't really talk about this much at all, and just says, we're going to be able to successfully see the collapse of Christianity and capitalism, and a new society will rise out of it. And it remains an optimistic work, even though he's just traced 2,000 years of terrible criminal behavior and a real crushing of the human spirit. He says, despite all that, the human spirit will still rise again and will overcome its problems.
So what does he mean when he's talking about Christianity? Because, of course, today you see the evangelicals internationally becoming this political power that's tightly linked with, I mean, it's, I think Matt Chrisman, a friend of the show, called evangelical Christianity like a fusion of Christianity with American capitalism.
Correct.
And you not only see their immense political power in the United States, but also throughout Latin America, and it's spreading the world, and they have blatantly reactionary politics, but also are incredibly well organized and yes. And driven towards taking power. Is that the kind of Christianity he's talking about, or was he talking about something else?
No, he's not, and I wish he had been, because there's been a resurgence of something that he thought was moribund, and indeed is an international threat, that there are Christians in Africa as well who are in favor of the most heinous policies of some of the African rulers there when it comes to homosexuality, women's rights, to clitorectomies, and it lines up horribly in the so-called third world, but also is united with Christians and fundamentalists in Europe as well. So it's unfortunate that he does not turn and recognize that, so that it seems to me that when I asked him to write some sort of preface or forward to this new edition, I thought he would be able to say, this is what's going on in America now, this is a book for the American audience, and you've now got Christian fundamentalism and Christian nationalism. He did not use any of those words, and instead of talking about Calvinism and the drive to make money, and it seems to me that's from the 1950s. That is not what America is like 70, 80 years later. So in that way, he's out of touch with the resurgence of Christianity here in America, and it's become openly fascist. Or that this alliance between, capitalism that is on the run, a billionaire class, white people who feel like their time of domination of all of the colors is ending. The same thing with men, their domination of women is ending. So you see an intense desperation on their part, and they have become very efficient at linking up with each other and fighting what they see as the ultimate battle. So that's nothing to be optimistic about at all. That's a very, very dark thing. And here in the United States, it seems like we may be setting this back ever so slightly by the election of Kamala Harris. But that this sweep that America has towards the right isn't just simply Trump or Trumpism. It's something that has been going on in the Christian right for 50 years, ever since the 1960s. So that it would be nice to be able to challenge Van Eyckham and do this, but he's not really in a situation, either politically or personally, to be able to do that. And we're going to have to do that work for ourselves.
Trying to understand a little bit more about what he means with the end of Christianity, he focuses on, in this book and other writing, specifically about heretic Christian sects. And in the situations, I think, were specifically very influenced by the Brethren of the Free Spirit, one of them. What was the importance of these sects? Why was this such a preoccupation for him and the Situationists?
Well, for two reasons. One is that there's the common perception that these heresies are all of one stripe, that they are all fanatics, and that if given power, they will end up killing large numbers of people. And this was the theory of Norman Cohen, who wrote In Pursuit of the Millennium, which was published after Nazism, which seemed to bear certain similarities to certain heretical groups or certain heresies, and that Cohn dismissed all of the medieval heresies as dangerous right-wing fanatics, and that what you saw you still can see, and what Van Eyckham saw with the situation he saw in the 1960s, especially with the flowering of the counterculture, was that there was an entirely different strain of these heretical movements that were not tending towards totalitarianism, but were intending towards anarchism, autonomous little regimes, not imposing certain rules, having goods in common, abolishing private property, abolishing work. So that one thing Van Eyckham had to do, or he saw that the end of Christianity meant, was to say, as Christianity ends, we can see that there's two strains of heresies, one of which is irremediably tied to Christianity, and it's really just its, you know, sort of a negative reflection of it. But then there are these anarchist outcroppings of heresies that split away from Christianity entirely, and that can now be looked at as either predecessors or inspirers for current activity. The other thing is to see what the content of those heresies were, and they're astonishingly modern. That one of the texts that I read from at the talk at NYU is something from 1295, and it's the Inquisitor condemning some of the Brethren of the Free Spirit, and what their alleged beliefs are sound like free love, sounds a lot like hippie beliefs or crypto proto-hippie beliefs. So that what Van Eyckham is interested in saying is, okay, when Christianity ends, we're going to need to recoup all the things that were good about heresies, because some of those heresies were not heresies. They were simply revolutionary movements that were labeled religious so that the Roman political power could get a handle on them, or that the various countries could get a handle on them. If they rejected all of politics, or if they rejected authoritarian politics, there was no way for certain of these power structures to be able to bring them back in and fight them. And the church was brought in to say, I know what we'll do. We'll label them heresies. We'll either impute religious beliefs to them, draw out religious beliefs for them, and then we can bring them into some sort of orbit we understand in order to crush them. If they were completely outside of Christianity and not catalogable as a heresy, political power had a very difficult time fighting them.
Was the central heresy of these groups this idea that since we're one with God, it's impossible to sin?
Yes, that the free spirit, that in the New Testament, the free spirit is something to is given by the New Testament and is given only through the mediation of Christ in the New Testament. But you could read this certain passage that mentions the free spirit as saying the free spirit exists in all individuals, irrespective of their membership in a church or not. And that was a dangerous double-edge, which is to say, okay, we want to break away from Judaism and the Old Testament, but not so far that people break away completely outside of all religions, completely. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Christianity, which was very much involved in the invention of modern capitalism, indeed in Calvinism and in Lutherism, is to break away from both of those constraints, not only the religious, but the economic, the political economic as well.
Because Christ said something like, it's okay to eat pork now, right? Like, you know, this is all old shit. Now we can think about religion in a more political way, essentially, and or a more social way. Today, you see right-wing Christians especially being very focused on, try not to use the term Old Testament, because I'm Jewish mm-hmm. myself, we don't call it that, but the, you know, the commandments, right. You know, Moses's commandments, which are, you know, it's not just 10, there's hundreds of them. And right. My impression was Christ just kind of nullified all of them. But now, especially like in the queer phobia, the transphobia, it's largely based on the religious right saying like, well, look, it says right here in the Old Testament that it's an abomination to masturbate, all this stuff.
Those are the passages that they know, yes. Right. I've seen several people on podcasts and on YouTube and on television saying, these Christians don't really read their Bible very well. They don't seem to realize many of the things that are attributed to Christ or get the general drift of it. And it's possible that they are stripping out all the things that they haven't read or don't want out of the Bible and are only focusing on the idea that Christ is a soldier, or you can become a soldier in Christ. And these images recur in Trumpism and in these far-right movements, is the warlike aspect of Christ, the Christ that was going to bring a sword to the so-called Old Testament. Because he says, okay, that's all the law. We're now overturning the law, and now it's going to be a question of a reign by love and faith. So that's, again, a very double-edged sword, which is throwing out these laws. Some of them may have been very good, but it's the attitude of saying, well, we are now perfect. We now do not need the laws. That is something that is very dangerous.
If we think about heretical sex today, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is like new religious movements, which people my age tend to see as cults.
Right.
And, you know, my first book about Posadism, I write a lot about what qualifies something as a cult is the, you know, a singular leader who everyone has to unify around and do what he says, and the abuse that comes with that.
Inevitable, inevitable abuse, yes.
So if we're trying to think of a more positive vision of a heretic sect today, is there anything you can think of?
Well, no, and this it sort of works in Van Eygham's favor, his point is that I think the people who have these truly enlightened attitudes towards sexuality, towards the relationship, towards nature, towards homosexuals, towards oneself, towards people of the opposite gender, of multiple genders, of transgenders, is that they're no longer hung up by religion whatsoever. That they do not need to have religion justify it or say, we can have these positions because it is in some ways in sync with the teachings of Jesus. That's over with. So I think that you can't find particular heretical groups that would then carry on for this because they've abandoned the idea of religion itself and are now saying we are beyond that, just as in the same way that we're beyond traditional politics.
So God may finally be dead.
So God may finally be dead. So the point that the phrase saying that you're an atheist is meaningless.
Right. People don't really call themselves that anymore.
Well, what they do, they say that I'm an atheist, but what I really mean is I'm against organized religion. Mm-hmm. And that's the other side of it, what is organized religion, has now become a reaction force to be able to maintain the privileges of certain threatened minority groups, as in the ruling class, where body of people, I think, are now willing to take positions with this out saying, I don't need a religious cover. Or they should be in a position to be able to say, I'm non-atheist. I'm non-theist rather mm-hmm. than I'm atheist. I'm not against God. This doesn't come up for me at all. And we don't hear that very much. We hear, you know, and the American political leaders right now are talking about some of these issues, but they always are still thanking God. Many of the
movements, Kamala, not so much, interestingly.
Kamala, not so much?
Yeah.
Waltz tends to speak about, you know, thank God. But again, that's not who we're necessarily looking for the politics that we want to follow. There are many, many radical groups that are active these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that covers everything I wanted to talk about. What other stuff have you written that you'd recommend to the readers or to our listeners?
The translations that I've done are generally tend to be translations of things that would not be translated otherwise. So one of the books that I think that the listeners should be aware of is the book of the translation of the statements of the Tarnak Nine, mm-hmm. who became the Tarnak Ten. These are people who presumably are the members of the Invisible Committee, the people who wrote the Coming Insurrection. And when they were arrested and charged as being the people who wrote these pamphlets, which was considered evidence used against them in court, or was going to be used in evidence in court, that they were the people who engaged in sabotage, and that good political activity that I thought would be useful is translating those texts, which were written in Julian Kapat's own name. There doesn't need to be speculation as to whether the de Kooninists morphed into the Invisible Committee or who wrote the Coming Insurrection. These are texts written in Yvonne Levy's own name and in her own voice, in Julian Kapat's own name and voice. And they're marvelous statements, very brave people, very articulate, with an extremely good critique of the use of terrorism as a form of anti-terrorism as a form of government rule. So the projects that I think that people would might be interested in, if these projects interest them, is the translation of the statements of the Tarnak Men, which I call the statements of the Tarnak Ten, because another defendant was added.
Yeah, really bravely facing down the court in a way that's, you know, I imagine if I ever went on trial, I would just do whatever my lawyer told me to do and say. And
these people did not do that. And it's very reminiscent of one of the situations we mentioned, René Rizel, who was engaged with José Bové for a couple of months in 1998, 1999. And instead of being simply opposed to transgenic corn or to the use of genetically modified organisms, they organized direct actions where they destroyed fields of genetically modified corn and maize. They destroyed McDonald's. And that Wiesel, when arrested, did not attempt to plea bargain his way out or say, oh, I've had a change of heart. I've seen that violence is not the answer. That he simply said to the court in Argennes, sentence me and I go gladly to jail. That I see people are outside protesting and I know that this is not going to crush our movement. And that's a similar strain in the Tarnak Nine and in one or two of the Situationists.
All right, and I'll add to that to check out the Not Bored Anthology, the collection of your zines from the 80s and 90s. And I think even younger listeners will find a lot interesting in there because you write a lot about not only situationism and your political activity, but also a lot of meditations on culture. Like I was reading this short essay on Dennis Rodman you wrote. There's another one that talks about Twin Peaks. And yeah, it's just filled with dozens of short essays like that.
So. Well, thank you for paying attention to them. And thank you for your time this afternoon. This has been a very good conversation.
Thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you.